It's Philosophy Talk.
I'm so glad you could all come. I will be reading to you from The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin.
Before Darwin, it was possible to believe that life was designed by an intelligent creator.
But Darwin showed that life is designed by the indifferent and dumb processes of blind nature.
Did Darwin kill God?
This is slander! Darwin was one of the greatest minds of all time!
And his ship was the Beagle, which reminds me of Snoopy, my favorite peanut.
By revealing how life really works, did Darwin make the world infinitely more interesting and comprehensible?
Or did he strip the world of mystery and enchantment?
Our guest is Daniel Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Evolution and the Meanings of Life.
We want you to teach alternative theories to Darwinian evolution.
You mean Lamarckian evolution?
The philosophical legacy of Darwin. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
On Wednesday, March 8th, come be part of a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about the philosophy of smell with experimental psychologist Asfa Majid.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody's welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Wednesday, March 8th at 7 p.m. in Leventhal Hall of the Stanford Humanities Center.
Smell you later.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the philosophical legacy of Charles Darwin.
You know, Ken, Darwin was many things, but not really a philosopher. He was what used to be called a naturalist. We'd call him a biologist today. But he was also a geologist, and he studied medicine, and he even studied for the clergy. He first became famous as an author because of his book, The Voyage of the Beagle. It was simultaneously a scientific journal and a riveting travel memoir. He had a five-year journey to remote places like the Galapagos Islands. But, of course, he's mainly remembered now for coming up with the theory of evolution by natural selection.
And it's precisely because of the theory of evolution that it's fair to talk about the philosophical legacy of Darwin. The theory of evolution is one of the single most important ideas in the history of biology, maybe even in the entire history of science. And there are people who believe that it's the single most important idea in the entire history of human civilization.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, there's the wheel, there's language, there's even God. That was a pretty influential idea. But there's no doubt that Darwin had a major impact on our understanding of the nature of life and its meaning.
Go back to that idea about God. I mean, consider the infamous design argument for the existence of God. It begins with the observation of life's orderliness, complexity, and apparent purposefulness. It adds that, therefore, life could not, to a very high degree of probability, be the result of random accident. And it concludes that in all likelihood, life must have been created and designed by a wise and intelligent designer, i.e. God.
Well, long before Darwin, Ken, both your buddy Kant and my buddy Hume gave powerful criticisms of the design argument.
Well, I'm not trying to claim that the design argument is philosophically irrefutable or that nobody before Darwin ever questioned it. You're right about Hume. But until Darwin, the design argument represented by far, I think, the best positive idea that anybody had for explaining the complexity and apparent purposefulness of life. Reject the design argument before Darwin, and you're left with one huge and imponderable mystery, John. But Darwin changed all that. He showed how blind, purposeless, unintelligent processes could explain all living things in all their complexity and in their apparent purposefulness.
That blind, purposeless, unintelligent process is the process of natural selection. Natural selection means that traits that make it more likely for an organism to survive and successfully reproduce get passed down from generation to generation.
Right. At the basic level, natural selection results from the interaction of three different things: variation, heritability, and differential reproduction.
Imagine you start out with a population of beetles, say. Say half of them are green and half of them are brown. That's variation.
And suppose that the brown beetles tend to have brown babies and green beetles tend to have green babies. That's heritability.
And finally, suppose that our beetles live among a species of beetle-eating birds, but that our birds are better at spotting the green beetles than the brown beetles. Green beetles are thus more likely to end up as bird food and less likely to end up making more green beetle babies. That's differential reproduction.
And now let this whole process of birth and feeding run for a few cycles, or maybe many cycles, and eventually you have a population of beetles that's no longer 50-50 brown-green, but more brown than green.
Darwin showed that if you have just those three things, variation, heritability, and differential reproduction, then natural selection will occur. And he argued that natural selection is the main process by which species and their traits are designed. Quote, by relentless tinkering with species, natural selection causes them to be adapted to their environments.
Darwinian explanations are everywhere these days, John, and a lot of them are cool, but not all of them are cool. I mean, think of so-called social Darwinism. That's a very crude ideology. People sometimes say, well, look, it's the survival of the fittest. Darwin taught us that. So they try to justify social hierarchy and social domination by appeal to that idea.
Well, or think of the more sophisticated, but still very controversial hypotheses of evolutionary psychologists, like the idea that men are evolved to have a certain propensity towards rape. That's the kind of thing that makes people reflexively reject Darwinian approaches.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to sort through here, the good and the bad about Darwin.
Luckily, to help us think through the philosophical implications of Darwin's legacy, we're going to be joined by Daniel Dennett. He's the author of many books inspired by Darwinian ideas, including one of my favorites, Freedom Evolves.
And we'd like our audience to help this conversation evolve as well. Join us by calling 1-800-5-
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or send us an email to comments@philosophytalk.org.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Molly Samuel, explains why it's no coincidence that Darwin came up with his theory of evolution after traveling to the Galapagos Islands. She files this report.
I'm on a rocky, windswept hill on the eastern side of California's Sierra Nevada Mountains with biologist Lyle Nichols of Santa Monica College.
Let's see, over here, so we're looking into Nevada. We're just a few miles from the border here, so most of this is in Nevada.
We're in Bodie State Historic Park, a gold mining ghost town, looking for pikas, which are small, cute, squeaky, hamster-sized relatives of rabbits.
They're sort of shaped like a beanbag.
The American pika is picky when it comes to choosing a home. They're sensitive to heat and only live at high elevations in the western states. They live in rock piles, hiding out beneath them when it gets too hot. They spend their days collecting grass and shrubs, making hay piles to eat during the winter. Nichols comes to Bodie in the summers to count the pikas.
There are four animals on this one, and there are two good hay piles that you can see here, and these guys have been really active.
So what do these little mammals living in the high, cold Bodie Hills have to do with Darwin's finches and the Galapagos Islands?
We do have habitat islands all around us.
Terry Gosliner is a scientist at the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco.
And one of the things that we find is that mountaintops are habitat islands.
What makes islands special is their isolation. Islands have plants and animals that are different from their cousins living anywhere else. Galapagos tortoises, Tasmanian devils, Hawaii's honeycreepers. Gosliner explains that after his voyage on the Beagle, Darwin noticed this phenomenon.
He was very familiar with habitats in South America, which allowed him to then see that many of the organisms that he was seeing in the Galapagos Islands had close relatives on the South American mainland, but the islands were very different.
By comparing these species to each other, Darwin saw that the various plants and animals were related but had evolved into separate species. He eventually arrived at natural selection as the mechanism that drives evolution.
That's why we call islands living laboratories of evolution.
They're like evolutionary petri dishes, narrow, isolated examples that demonstrate how evolution works everywhere else. Island life can be pretty good, but because of their isolation, islands are also laboratories for extinction.
And in these days of climate change and other huge conservation issues, the organisms that live on islands are the ones that are most likely to become extinct most quickly.
And here's where the pikas come in. Those cool mountaintops in the Sierra Nevada might as well be islands as far as pikas are concerned. The animals can't survive at lower altitudes in environments that don't have their preferred rock pile homes.
Pikas are really cold adapted animals.
Lyle Nichols.
Once the temperature gets much above 20 degrees C, which is room temperature, you know, they're not active on the surface. They'll be down in the rocks where it's cooler.
The pikas at Bodie are an unusual population. They live in the rock piles created by old gold mining operations. So in their case, human impact on the environment has actually been a good thing. To a point. Terry Gosliner of the California Academy of Sciences reminds us of the problem with island-like isolation.
If you think of organisms that are found only on the highest mountaintops, they have no place to go. They are going to become extinct if we continue to see the impact of climate change that everyone predicts.
Some scientists, including Lyle Nichols, think that pika populations are already shrinking because of warmer temperatures.
I don't see any fresh droppings, so I think we're safe saying this territory doesn't have anybody on it.
The effects of climate change may not be obvious everywhere, but just as islands showed Darwin where species came from, now islands and island-like places are showing us where the planet could be going. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Molly Samuel.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Daniel Dennett. He's professor of philosophy from Tufts University, where he's also co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies, and he's author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Evolution and the Meanings of Life. Dan, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's good to be with you again.
Dan, you're a philosopher, at least that's how you started out. Now you're many things, but you really weren't trained as an evolutionary biologist. But obviously, you find Darwin philosophically fascinating. Did thinking about the problems of philosophy lead you into thinking about Darwin?
In fact, it did, John. When I was just starting out, I was thinking about learning in the brain, and it hit me that it had to be a sort of quasi-evolutionary process, a Darwinian process in the neurons, and that got me interested in Darwin right there. And the more I read, the more I thought, these are wonderful ideas, and they illuminate just about everything that I was interested in.
Well, now, the title of your book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, suggests that you think Darwin's ideas are unsafe. Unsafe for whom?
It's funny. When I published that book about 15 years ago, people said, why dangerous? They don't ask me that as often. Now, it's sort of obvious. Darwin's idea is more revolutionary than a lot of people are willing to acknowledge or are comfortable with. It inverts a very ancient and very sensible idea, and that is what you might call the trickle-down theory of creation. It takes a big, fancy, intelligent thing to make something wonderful. And he said, no, in fact, you can have a process which isn't intelligent, which has no purpose, which is just blind and mechanical, and nevertheless, it will generate over the eons things of stunning beauty and elegance and of great efficiency, wonderful designs. And he demonstrated it. How it would work. And that really is a very upsetting idea. A lot of people who aren't themselves religious nevertheless have great trouble with this idea.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Are these ideas only dangerous to people who are religious, who believe that there must be an intelligence at the foundation of the universe? Suppose I'm a thoroughly modern naturalist and I think, well, it's all just stuff happening anyway. Is there any danger to me, the thoroughly modern naturalist, in Darwin's ideas?
Well, I used not to think so, but in fact, one of the main reasons I wrote the book back then was I found all these people who weren't religious, who were in fact some of them scientists, at least they were academics, who were profoundly unhappy with this aspect of Darwin's work, and found the whole idea of evolutionary explanations, particularly in the humanities, somehow deeply repugnant.
Why would that be? I mean, some of the reaction to what's called evolutionary psychology, where you take the theory of evolution and try to design it to the apply it to the design of the human mind, really upsets some people. Why is that?
Well, I think it's a sort of leftover Cartesianism. They still want the mind to be a sort of a mystery and a supercalifragilistic. They don't want it to be just a bunch of tricks. And, of course, what you learn from evolution is that living things are wonderful bags of tricks. But when you start looking more closely, you see that's all it is. It's a bag of tricks all the way down. And if that upsets you, then you're not going to want to see the success of an evolutionary biological theory of mind.
So, Dan, just a quick answer. Was Darwin himself upset by the unsafe aspects of his idea?
Oh, yeah. That seems to be the case. I'm not an expert on Darwin biography, but he held off, of course, publishing for a long time. His wife, Emma, was deeply religious, and he was worried about the effect on her. He understood, I think, exactly what the implications of his views were.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing Darwin with Dan Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea.
In our next segment, we'll dig into the details of this whole alliterative subject, the theory of natural selection, and examine what Darwinian approaches can and cannot explain. Can Darwinian thinking really explain why men are prone to rape or how freedom evolved? Are there alternatives to Darwinian approaches? Or is Darwinism now just the only game in town? You can join us by calling toll-free 1-800.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
And you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Darwinism, its limits and its competitors, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Darwin reduced humans to little more than walking, talking, philosophy book-writing apes? Or did his theory of evolution give us a new appreciation for the complexity, maybe even the dignity of our species? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. How much about life, especially human life, can Darwinian thinking really explain? Can it explain how the mind really works, how freedom or morality arose, how human cultures and societies change over time? Are there any serious scientific alternatives to Darwinian approaches? Tell us what you think.
The number is 1-800-525-9977.
You're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And finally, you can post a comment to share with the world on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Dan Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea.
So, Dan, there are people who purport to be scientifically grounded, who want to either entirely reject or radically modify or moderately modify Darwin's basic approach. They range from people way over on the right, say, who favor intelligent design, and others, more on the left, say, who think we need more biological processes than just natural selection alone to explain living structures, sort of developmental systems. Tell us, is there any serious scientific controversy about Darwinianism still remaining?
There's serious controversy only about the extent to which Darwinism, neo-Darwinism, has to be adjusted to make room for new discoveries, for instance, in developmental biology. But developmental biology, evo-devo, so-called,
right,
is still it's a new and wonderful wrinkle to neo-Darwinism.
Explain evo-devo a little bit to our listeners.
Well, perhaps using a couple of caricatures, the caricature of non-evo-devo Darwinism is, look, you got your genes, and then you got your adults, and the genes are the blueprints for the adults, and how that process happens is of secondary interest. We don't care. You got a gene for this and a gene for that, and you find the adults have those genes, and that's all we need to talk about. Well, it turns out that the processes of getting from the DNA and the genes and all the other elements there through development, there's a tremendous amount of value added, a tremendous amount of fascinating and important process that goes on in development, which means that we have to complicate our theories of the relationship between the DNA and the living organism,
right,
a great deal.
Evo-devo people reject sort of genetic determinism, and some people think, I think wrongly, that Darwinianism implies or entails a kind of genetic determinism, that it's all in the genes because those are the things, yep, that are selected and replicated, but there's more going on. And you say that's there's serious science about that, right? That's a serious scientific
debate. Certainly, and in any case, even aside from evo-devo, Evolution isn't all just about genes. There's cultural evolution as well. And it often doesn't matter, as it were, to nature whether a particular good trick that an organism has come through the genes or has been passed on from parent to offspring. For instance, a lot of behavior of mammals and birds, building their nests, their songs, what they choose to eat, how they hunt, their mate preferences, are actually passed on not through their genes. These used to be called instincts. They're not. There's an instinctual basis, but the actual information is passed on from parent to offspring. And the proof of this is that if you do cross-fostering, if you take the birds, the eggs out of one nest and put them in another species' nest and vice versa, so that the chicks grow up with adoptive parents, a lot of their behaviors will be the behavior of their adoptive parents, not of their genetic parents.
Well, in reading about this, which I haven't done nearly enough of, there's this concept of a meme that comes up as some kind of Darwinian idea or based on Darwin that's going to explain cultural evolution and development. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Richard Dawkins introduced the term in his book, The Selfish Gene, back in 76. And it's been very controversial ever since. I'm one of those that thinks it's a very important idea.
You love the idea.
I love the idea. It's been given a bad press. It's been criticized both by people in the humanities who hate the idea of an evolutionary encroachment into their terrain, and by some evolutionary biologists who think we don't need anything in addition to the gene. I ask them, what about words? Do you think words exist? And they say, of course words exist. I say, well, words are memes that can be pronounced.
So right. What is the definition of a meme?
A meme is a cultural replicator that has its features because it has survived in differential replication just the way genes do.
It's like the cultural analog of the gene. But you know, before we get into that, which is a fascinating topic, and I want to probe you, I want to give you a chance to discuss another purported scientific controversy about evolution. And this is this intelligent design hypothesis. And you know, I have to say, a little bit to spare, one of my favorite philosophers has recently recommended as one of the best books of the year, one of these intelligent design authors. Is that a serious scientific controversy about intelligent design and evolution or not?
No, it's not. It just isn't. And yes, I'm disappointed in Tom Nagel as well. I think he's being, surprisingly for a man of his sophistication, he's being very naive. He's taken a book which is propaganda, which has not been reviewed by the scientific community at all, and because it's cleverly written and very engaging, he's bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Dan, that means there are intelligent, sophisticated people who are gripped by the arguments for intelligent design. Tom Nagel's fool.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's why I wrote my book. That's why Darwin's a dangerous idea. Some people, and he has admitted to me, he just can't stand the idea that all of this wonderfulness arises out of a purposeless, blind, mechanical process. He says we've got to find some alternative to what he calls reductionism on the one hand and creationism on the other. And I think he's underestimating the resources and, in fact, the glory of reductionism done right.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophical legacy of Charles Darwin with Dan Dennett, one of the people in the world best suited to help us understand that legacy. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or last but not least, go to our blog and post a comment for the world to share at the blog.philosophytalk.org. And Matt in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Thank you. I wanted to say that my undergraduate education was in zoology, so I had a lot of evolution in my education, and it's something that informs my view of the world and humanity. But what I am appalled at is how many people who are very well educated, and I had this epiphany come to me when I was in a conversation with two people who had doctorates from Harvard, how lacking so many people's, and I'm not talking like just Bible thumper types, but educated progressive people, they just don't understand natural selection. And so they will apply it to social situations, and they just simply don't understand what they're talking about.
Can you give us a concrete example real quickly?
I'm going to try to remember that we were talking about education and how things are passed on to generations, and they didn't really understand the idea of selection, and they were thinking more in terms of like attitudes and those kind of things being passed down, and they didn't have a distinction between social kind and cultural stuff versus traits that are affected.
Matt, thanks for the question. Dan, I think Matt's saying he doesn't like your idea of cultural evolution. I mean, that sounds like kind of what's underneath him, that you can't really explain social transmission by the same kind of mechanisms you can explain biological transmission by. That sounds like what he was objecting to.
Well, maybe you're right. In any case, let me defend and clarify a little bit. For thousands of years, we've known that cultures change over time. So in that minimal sense, they evolve. And we've identified lots of cultural treasures, music and art and science and architecture and ways of building boats and all the rest of it. And we know that this is culturally transmitted, and we know that it changes over time. And the big question is, are the processes by which those changes occur, are they always, as one tradition would have it, the sort of un-Darwinian tradition, is it always because people appreciate and like what they see, and so they treat these things as valuable possessions, as treasures to be husbanded and then to be bequeathed to their next generations? Well, a lot of culture is, of course, transmitted in that way, and the human comprehension of the items in question is very much at the forefront. But there's a lot of culture that is not transmitted that way and is, in fact, the foundation of the rest of culture. Just take words. Not one word in 1,000 is coined or invented by an individual. Words have a clear evolutionary history. They have lineages going back thousands of years, and they survive by differential replication. Words that nobody uses go extinct. Words that everybody uses stick around, and they subtly change over the years, and not as a result of anybody trying to make them change. That's cultural evolution, too, and that's where you need the concept of memes.
So to go back just a little to the Tom Nagel debate, and I don't really want to talk about Tom Nagel because I haven't read Tom Nagel stuff, but I know what my reaction will be. My reaction's always the same. I always agree with what Dan Dennett says, and I agree with what Tom Nagel feels. That is, I mean, you're great at explaining evolution and rebutting objections to it and making it all clear, but you're also so enthusiastic, right? I mean, you really think that all the things about, or all the important things about human dignity and our feelings about ourselves and culture that have heretofore been based on various kinds of religious and humanistic myths can really be resuscitated within an evolutionary point of view. At least I think you think that. Is that right? And can you see how maybe that's just an expression of your own enthusiastic cup is half full personality, and it might leave some of the rest of us just depressed?
Well, no, I understand that exactly, and I think you've put it very well, and you're exactly right about Tom Nagel. He doesn't have the arguments, but he's got a gut that has gut feelings that a lot of people share, and he has the courage to express them and the eloquence to express them quite wonderfully. You're exactly right that I don't think we need the myths. I think we maybe needed the myths, that we had to have these myths to embody these wonderful ideas, but I don't think we need it anymore. For instance, let's talk about ethics for a moment. I don't think we need the idea that God tells us what to do one little bit. I don't think we need God for ethics at all. I think what we need to understand is that we human beings over the eons have come together and communicated and persuaded each other about what the right way to live is. We haven't finished that job. But if you compare the morality of today with the morality of 2,000 years ago, you'll see that it's not because God If God changed what he was telling us to do, it's because people decided that God wasn't telling us to do the right things.
Yeah, Dan, those are important things. I'm going to challenge you about that a bit, but we've got a lot of callers on the line, so I'm going to let some of them in. 1-800-525-9.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or go to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and leave a comment for the world to see. Jay in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jay.
Thanks. My question is that what would be the evolutionary explanation for our repulsion to the idea of evolution, and what is the evolutionary explanation for why we're so attracted to the humanitarian myth or the humanist myth, like romantic myth?
Well, Jay, let's put that question. Does there have to be an evolutionary explanation of everything, Dan? Those sound like not plausible candidates to me for an evolutionary explanation. But
It all depends what you mean by an explanation. I would say that it is puzzling in a way that we should find this so offensive, but I think it's easy enough to see what the answer might be, not that evolution has yet worked this out in any way. We human beings, we are the makers, the devisers, the inventors. And this is a wonderful thing that we do. We're painters and artists and musicians and composers and engineers and all the rest. And we model the whole world, the whole of, as we say, creation, on our own creative talents and abilities. And for Darwin to come along and say, well, this is a very recent development, this creating from the top down, understanding what you're doing. No other species really does that, and evolution itself doesn't do it. That's a profoundly upsetting idea. It's upsetting in the same way it was upsetting several hundred years ago to figure out that that our planet is not the center of the universe.
Well, I understand that, but I don't see why evolution has any deep explanation of why we would be upset in the light of the explosion of our myths. We're myth-making creatures, I agree about that, and I think evolution can explain how we came to be myth-making creatures, but I don't think it can explain anything about what myths will appeal to us and why they appeal to us. That's a complicated cultural thing and has to do with all kinds of stuff. So I don't quite see the evolutionary explanation there, Dan.
Well, maybe this is one of those cases where you don't want an evolutionary explanation because it's really better explained at a higher level where we've got evolution presupposed as a background.
Well, isn't it pretty obvious? It's just that people who reject the myths of their community don't get slept with as often as people who embrace them.
Well, that depends. Some artists who reject the myths of their community get slept with quite a lot, you know.
There was a little news piece just today in the paper I saw where somebody's done an experiment where men and women, I think probably undergraduates, male and female as usual, were shown little descriptions, resumes of other people of their same gender. In other words, you were basically being introduced to some of your sexual rivals in these in the preview, and then you were asked questions, and it turned out that people who had been exposed to resumes of attractive rivals of their own gender answered questions about religiosity more positively. They claim to be more religious. So maybe that's it.
Yeah,
maybe it's like the guitar theory. I think a million guitars a year must be sold on the idea that this is the way to get members of the opposite sex into bed with you. And maybe religion plays a similar role.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophical legacy of Charles Darwin with Dan Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea.
In our final segment, we'll look at the broader legacy, scientific, philosophical, and cultural, of Charles Darwin. Not just biologists and philosophers, but also many psychologists, cultural anthropologists, and even a growing number of economists see themselves as standing on the shoulder of Darwin. Does the spread of Darwinism just represent a late-blooming intellectual fad, or is it really helping us solve some of the deepest mysteries about the human mind and human culture?
What Darwin hath wrought, for good or for ill, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Yeah, you and your cat named Felix, both wrapped up in that double helix, is what we call intelligent design.
Intelligent design is one of many reactions to Darwinian evolution. What other theories have emerged in Charles Darwin's wake? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Dan Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea.
In this segment, we want to get into some applications outside of strict biology of Darwin's ideas. And we've got an email from Elizabeth Milosh in San Francisco that really raises one of the questions that we hinted at in our introduction. And that's the issue of evolutionary psychology and the idea that you can get a biological or an evolutionary explanation of why men are inclined towards rape. She says that recent discoveries about archaeological discoveries about Ardi and her tribe suggests that this isn't so. It has to do with the fact that men's canine teeth and female canine teeth are more similar to each other as opposed to those found in other primates. In other words, she says, men could have concluded back then that they would get much further with honey than with vinegar when it comes to women. This is important because people tend to rush to conclusions and would falsely state that men are biologically destined to commit rape if you don't include this important discovery. So I haven't read all of her interesting comment, but the point is that there seems to be this issue in evolutionary psychology that's getting a lot of attention and really focused attention, so that you look at canine teeth and that's supposed to help you figure out whether men are prone to rape. Is this a really emerging science, or is this just so much stuff about nothing?
I don't know that particular argument before. I never heard it. And it's everybody, I think, realizes that it's very hard to get the right sorts of facts and the right sort of confidence in those facts to say a whole lot about the conditions under which our species evolved several million years ago. But there are some pretty good signs. I mean, sexual dimorphism, the difference in size and strength between males and females, is a feature that has very clear implications and parallels if we look at different species, and we start with the basic imbalance, the fact that males, this is as good as just definitive of being a male, and males can make billions and billions of sperm, and females can only make hundreds of eggs, and can only give birth to in a mammal can only give birth to, let's say, a dozen offspring, whereas males can in principle have many, many more offspring than that. This fact is just as much a fact about us as it is about
Dan,
many other species.
Dan, wait a minute. So are you suggesting, so there's a surplus sperm theory of the male propensity to rape, right? If it's going to increase.
No, that's not the point.
Oh, okay. So that's, yeah, not the.
No, no.
So, yeah.
No, that's not the point. That's the point of that is that if we look at many, many species, birds, mammals, across the spectrum, we see that females are the choosy ones. They are the ones that have to be courted. They are the ones that have to be impressed by the males. And that's as true of our species as it is of say, birds and mammals generally. And so the term, perhaps it was unfortunate, was coy. Females are coy. Males are not so coy because they don't, as it were, risk losing something by a suboptimal mating. They've got plenty of sperm. They can,
right. So male and female are differentially situated with respect to the reproductive challenge. Let's put it that way.
That's right.
And it makes it a good design feature that they have different kind of mate choice strategies and all that. That seems right.
Yep.
But one of the things that bothers people about this evolutionary psychology kind of line, one of the things that bothers them, I don't know if it's the only thing, is that people somehow think that you slide, and you mentioned the evolution of morality. People somehow think that you can, that evolution devotees slide from a description of what is the case and what has been the case to what ought to be the case. Like somehow, if males are designed by evolution to as an adaptation to have some sort of propensity to rape, let's suppose that's true, then since it's an adaptation, and adaptation is about what's in some sense good for the organism, then it must be a good thing that males are. But we abhor
and
rape.
That is such a canard.
Tell me why.
Well, the people who draw that conclusion are not the evolutionists. They're the ones on the other side who are scared that this is the conclusion that's being drawn. But although I think maybe if you went back 100 years, you would find second-rate, even really objectionable evolutionists drawing that conclusion, evolutionary psychologists go out of their way not to make that draw that conclusion.
So tell me how to think. So you mentioned something about the evolution of morality. So tell me how to think about moral norms in regard to the evolutionary theories. And tell me how to think about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that, Ken, because I've actually written a lot about it.
I'm careful not to go into lecture mode here.
Evolutionary explanations will not tell you what you ought to do. That is not, you can't derive an ought from an is. But they can certainly tell you a lot about the background conditions and how we got to where we are. And they can also tell you something about what is possible. And then we can look at both what's possible and what you might say what's easy and what's difficult. And what the evolutionary models that have looked at morality show is that, indeed, we seem to have a leg up. We have some very nice instincts, if you like, some built-in dispositions to make moral judgments of certain sorts. That does not show that those judgments are right. It shows that they are only that they are natural, that they are easy to get to from where we start. Now, the history of morality is, in some regards, a history of overcoming our basic human nature. And the reasons that we want to overcome features in our basic human nature, that's what we do basically in a political discussion.
Let's slow down a little bit. Because our instincts, well, you know, our sort of moral instincts, let's talk about that. And we might think they're somehow constrained by evolution, but they're all over the place. I mean, we're the same people who... the same biology that led to the enslavement of millions from Africa and the exploitation of labor and the Holocaust, that's the same biology that leads to democracy and you know, a commitment to human rights. The creatures that do the one thing are not biologically different from the creatures that do the other thing. So how is evolution going to help us get any leg up on understanding the distribution of moral instincts and moral formations and all that? How is it going to help us do that?
Well, first of all, I think you're exactly right, is that there are instincts which are really quite universal, and they don't seem to do the trick because they are overridden by all sorts of considerations. But we should know what they are, and we should know that, in fact, indeed, the most evil people, the most thoughtless people, and the most concerned people actually share, unless they are, in some sense, pathological, right. And there are, of course, people that are, they share a whole lot of moral instincts. And the important thing, in fact, for the ethicist is to recognize this and not make the mistake of treating those intuitions, which are really part of our sort of human nature, as specifically insights into truth. They may not be. The fact that you have an instinct or an intuition which tells you it's okay for me to refrain from acting here and let somebody die, that's okay, but if I were to push that person into death, that would be terrible. Well, maybe so, but it may also be that this is the dictates of an intuition which, first of all, you have no idea where it comes from. It's just a heartfelt intuition on your part, and we really should figure out whether this is grounded in good reasons or whether it's a sort of a reflex that you happen to have.
Well, Dan, it seems to me that culture is basically, and this is not a negative comment, a big trick that humans play on nature. I mean, my illustrations would be condoms and aspirin, right? Condoms allow you to do something that nature gives you pleasure in doing because it wants you to procreate without procreating. Ha ha, nature. And aspirins allow you to do things that are supposed to cause pain, like play soccer, without having the pain. Ha ha, nature. Now, isn't your theory of morality kind of just an extension of that, that we can pick and choose among the things nature gave us, and so we can take that little reed of sympathy that Hume talks about and decide that a lot of our educational system should be based on giving that a great deal more importance than evolution would give it?
Well, I don't see why it would be giving it more importance than evolution would give it, but I agree with you. I think that human culture is, in a very large measure, a set of techniques, tricks, as you say, it's a term that I like to use too, a bunch of good tricks that our species has learned over the over the eons and is passed down culturally, not through the genes, mm-hmm. in order to improve, optimize human nature, if you like, in many regards. And we're continuing with that process. And I think that's a good way of looking
on,
at it.
On that note of agreement between you and John Dan, I'm going to mm-hmm. thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Delighted to join you.
Our guest has been Daniel Dennett. He's professor of philosophy at Tufts University, where he's also co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies, and he's author of many, many books, including Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Evolution and the Meanings of Life. So, John, how did your thoughts evolve throughout this
program? I love reading and talking to Dan Dennett, although I can't always keep up with the reading, but he's very prolific. But, you know, there's a lot of philosophical talents. There's being smart, there's being acute, there's being analytical, there's being critical. But I think we underestimate enthusiasm,
yeah.
right? I mean, almost infectious enthusiasm. And that's I think, one of the things yeah. that makes Dennett really stand out.
Yeah, that's one of the things that he and I have in common that sort of makes you recoil in
weariness from time to time.
It doesn't come naturally.
yeah, I mean, you love the... I'm not quite sure you're a lover of gung-ho. Yes, everything is dead and rebuild.
You guys, like Kant, are impressed by the starry heaven above, and I guess the moral law or the genetic law within, and I'm just kind of put off by
of
them.
This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. We've already got a conversation going. Join it, and also check out our Facebook page.
And you can download podcasts of our program as well. For the final word, we turn to one of the most evolved of thinkers, Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes. When Charles Darwin's Origin of Species was first published in 1859, religious types immediately recognized its threat to faith. Not only in the book's insistence that life itself was not fixed, but in the implication that if animals change and evolve over time, so do, and so have, humans. Darwin himself only mentioned human origins once in the book. He wrote, "Much light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history," and that was it. Darwin formed his theory based on observations he made during his famous 5-year voyage on the Beagle. Darwin's memoir of that voyage became a bestseller. Between the publication of that book and Origin, more than 20 years passed. What took so long? Well, Darwin was a sick man for most of his adult life. The nature of his illness has been a matter of conjecture, ranging from Chagas disease to lactose intolerance to plain old hypochondria. Most theories suggest there was a combination of physical and psychosomatic disorders. His symptoms included flatulence, diarrhea, rashes, vomiting, dizziness, heart palpitations, and an intolerance for the weight of books. Whenever he read a book, supposedly, he first had to rip it up in sections to make it light enough for him to read. Which leads to my personal hunch that it took him so long to write Origin because it was too heavy for him. He knew its ripples would create a tsunami. He didn't want to deal with it. He'd also been something of a slacker as a young man, earning the displeasure of his father, so perhaps he wanted to prove himself to his old man, but was also fearful of disappointing him. He spent those years painstakingly gathering evidence, working only 4 hours a day. He worked in secret, sending his notes only to a few close friends. He procrastinated. It wasn't until a man named Alfred Russel Wallace published a paper on the introduction of species with views similar to Darwin's own that Darwin was finally forced to finish his book. According to anti-Darwinist Andrew J. Bradbury, quote, "illness provided a mighty shield behind which Darwin could hide rather than having to enter the public forum to argue for his ideas," unquote. When the book was finally published and was attacked, Darwin indeed did not defend it, but watched from the sidelines as his defenders, among them T.H. Huxley, nicknamed Darwin's Bulldog, went after attackers for him. Now, it seems that Darwin was a good husband, though his devout wife Emma was dismayed by his theories, and loving father, but was he a secret atheist, as many critics have surmised? Darwin is cagey about his own personal religious beliefs. At an after-dinner conversation, he once asked guests why they called themselves atheists. He preferred the word agnostic, a term coined by his friend T.H. Huxley. A guest replied that agnostic was but atheist writ respectable, and atheist was only agnostic writ aggressive. Darwin responded, "Why should you be so aggressive?" Perhaps Darwin was what we might call today passive-aggressive. In his autobiography, however, we do find these strong words, quote, "We overlook the probability of the constant inculcation of a belief in God on the minds of children producing so strong an effect in their brains, not yet fully developed, that it would be as difficult for them to throw off their belief in God as for a monkey to throw off its instinctive fear and hatred of a snake," unquote. After his death in 1892, his widow Emma and son Arthur had those words removed from the first edition of the autobiography, but they were finally restored in the 1958 edition, which may indicate that books, like species, change over time. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 62nd Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Men are sort of evoluted from the old world monkeys.
Did you hear that, my friend? Old world monkeys. According to Mr. Case, you and I aren't even descended from good American monkeys.